I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Kim Campbell is our worship leader. Kim is a queer woman, public historian, and historic preservationist whose interest in public memory dates to her childhood. Kim is currently a senior project manager at Ethos Preservation, a local preservation consulting firm. She holds an MA in public history with a concentration in historic preservation from the University of South Carolina, and a BA in history from Mercer University. In addition to a fascination with the stories writ large in our built environment, Kim is an avid bike commuter, triathlete, and Lego builder. She lives in Savannah with Wyatt Earp and Oscar Wilde, her canine children. Kevin Ion will bring our love at the center moment. Our worship, religious education, and covenant group theme for January is practicing resistance. And we're very proud of the UUs who yesterday were on the streets resisting. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we're working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be, and wherever you are on your journey. If you're visiting with us this morning and you would like to introduce yourself, please rise or raise your hand. An usher will bring a microphone, specifically Jane Rago in the back. As part of our commitment to accessibility, we use microphones when we talk so that people on Facebook and throughout the congregation can hear us. Do we have any visitors on this side? Oh, please stand.
So we are visiting from Colorado, spending a month here, and pretty much clear we're going to move. So, and looking for a home-based community. My background is I was raised Quaker, Evan's Jewish, and this seems like a good place to look for a home base.
Welcome.
You didn't say our names. So. This is Catherine, and I'm Evan, and we're really, really happy to be here. Thank you.
Welcome. I think there's somebody right behind them.
Hi, we're Barbara and Michael Yates from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Transylvania County in Brevard, Western North Carolina.
And we're currently escaping the ice storm.
The whole concept of north and south and east and west is kind of strange with this storm.
I'm Will. I'm from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Charlotte, and I'm here for 3-ish months for work, so came in to check it out on a Sunday.
Welcome. Do we have anyone else on this side? How about this size? Ah. We have our friend Malcolm.
Malcolm McKenzie, and from 506 East Oglethorpe Avenue. And I'm here as a guest of Cindy Copeland.
Welcome. Anyone else? We welcome you all. If you're looking for a new faith community, we encourage you to visit several times. We're different every time. To get a feel for our worship style and our approach to matters of faith and religion. It's good to have you all with us. Please join us in Ron Hall for refreshments following the service. You find Ron Hall by going through that door and straight to the other building. Or it's not really straight, it's kind of crooked. Or you can go out the front, follow the crowd around the building, or ask the ushers. They'll be glad to point you in the right way. Please come have coffee so we can get to know you. There are two cards in the pew in front of you or the pew back. One is if you'd like to be on our mailing list, this yellow card will just give us your, we send out emails twice a week, Tuesday and Friday. We don't inundate you with it, but it lets you know what's happening in the next week. And you get a welcome note from our minister who's not with us today. Joys and Sorrows is the other one. I'll read those later. If you would like me to, you can mark whether you want me to read them aloud or if you just want them to go to the minister for her, for your use. We appreciate those. And you can just put them in the collection plate when the collection plate goes around. Church, as I said, the church announcements are read. I'm going to point out a couple of them, but there's a lot going on if you look at the insert in our order of service today. But let me point out a few things. One today is music with Miss Becca. Becca Flaherty is our wonderful pianist and music director. So right after the service, it's going to be important for everybody to go out, go around to coffee, so that the kids can sing. And if you'd like to stay and listen to the kids sing or participate as a sing-along, it's only 15 minutes just to get the kids warmed up. You're welcome to stay after the service. UU Game Night is Saturday, January 31st, from 7 to 9 in Ron Hall. Bill and Jackie Pearson are fantastic about keeping us busy with activities in Ron Hall, and they're great at game night. If you have your own particular games you want to bring, you can bring those. Reverend Lisa is seeking readers for next Sunday service, February 1st. The service will lift up stories of Unitarians, Universalists, and Unitarian Universalists who showed up for justice, as you all did, many of you did, yesterday. Also, next Sunday after the service, a members' congregational meeting called for by petition will review the board process and the board process used to remove a person from our membership. And finally, we have the Celebrating Families. If you haven't participated in this, essentially we cook and serve people in need. And Chris Carroll, where's Chris? There she is. She's sticking her head right there. She'll be glad to tell you about it. She particularly needs someone to help her. She's willing to cook if you're willing to help her serve on the 10th. But it's an ongoing thing. There are several dates, and she has a sheet for you in Ron Hall. All right. With our lighting of our chalice, the symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. Our chalice lighter this morning is Jennifer Hyland. She's back in town. In the Unitarian Universalist faith, our chalice is symbolic of the light of reason, the warmth of community, and the flame of hope. Today, our chalice words come from Pat Uribe Lichty. We face a challenge to democracy, a challenge that calls us to hope in moments of despair, a challenge that asks us to persist in the faith, that we can and must make a difference. May our flaming chalice recommit us to the truth in our words and our actions, that we may live as we believe people should live.
Good morning. Thank you all for welcoming me here today. Our call to worship this morning is called Justice is Our Prayer by Rebecca Savage. We gather today with sacred intention to declare that justice is our prayer. We affirm in covenant with the beloved community that it is possible. Not here, not quite yet. The seeds have been planted time and again, and we remember all those who went before us who made beloved community a dream that could be realized. Justice is our prayer. May our time of worship together continue to water the budding trees of our diverse interdependence. May our time of worship give air and nourishment to the parts of our collective spirits that need to grow and thrive, that embrace equity as a known way of being. Justice is our prayer. We affirm in covenant with the beloved community that it is possible. May it be so. Let us worship together.
Hi, friends. Can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay. All right, we're reading a story called The Snail and the Whale, and the writer is Julia Donaldson. Are you guys familiar with any of her other books? Elias, where you're nodding vigorously. Which other books? Do you remember the names? The Gruffalo and Room on the Broom. You do? It's so good, right? So one of the reasons I love Julia Donaldson is her books are very lyrical. Do Do you guys know what lyrical means?
Yeah.
No. Amelia?
Like a song.
Like a song. Just like a song. Yeah, Harris, were you going to say the same thing?
That was...
Yeah, like poetry or a song. Yeah, so they're really fun to read. Lydia?
I see the snail.
You see the snail? Where is it?
It's on his tail.
It's on his tail. He's super tiny, right?
So the tail on the whale.
The snail. The rhymes are good in this one. So the story, one reason I really like the story is it's about the power of people and animals and snails, that even if we're small, we can make a big difference. And even if we're big, sometimes we need some help, right? So, enjoy The Snail and the Whale. This is the tale of a tiny snail and a great big gray blue humpback whale. This is a rock as black as soot, and this is a snail with an itchy foot. The sea snail slithered all over the rock and gazed at the sea and the ships and the dock. And as she gazed, she sniffled and sighed. The sea is deep and the world is wide. How I long to sail, said the very tiny snail. These are the other snails in the flock who all stuck tight to the smooth black rock and said to the snail with the itchy foot, be quiet, don't wiggle, sit still, stay put. But the tiny sea snail sniffled and sighed, then cried, I've got it, I'll hitch a ride. This is the trail of the tiny snail, a silvery trail that looped and curled and said, ride wanted around the world. This is the whale who came one night when the tide was high and the stars were bright, a humpback whale immensely long who sang to the snail a wonderful song of shimmering ice and coral caves and shooting stars and enormous waves. And this is the tale of the humpback whale who held it out of the starlit sea and said to the snail, come sail with me. This is the sea so wild and free that carried the whale and the snail on his tail to towering icebergs and far-off lands with fiery mountains and golden sands. These are the waves that arced and crashed, that foamed and frolicked and sprayed and splashed, the tiny snail on the tail of the whale. These are the caves beneath the waves where colorful fish with feathery fins and sharks with hideous, toothy grins swam past the whale and the snail on his tail. This is the sky, so vast and high, sometimes sunny and blue and warm, sometimes filled with a thunderstorm, with zigzag lightning flashing and frightening the tiny snail on the tail of the whale. And she gazed at the sky, the sea, the land, the waves and the caves and the golden sand. She gazed and gazed, amazed by it all, and she said to the whale, I feel so small. But then came the day the whale lost his way. These are the speedboats running a race, zigging and zooming all over the place, upsetting the whale and with their ear-splitting roar, making him swim too close to the shore. This is the tide slipping away. And this is the whale lying beached in a bay. Quick, off the sand, back to the sea, cried the snail. I can't move on land, I'm too big, moaned the whale. The snail felt helpless and terribly small. Then, I've got it, she cried, and started to crawl. I must not fail, said the tiny snail. This is the bell on the school in the bay, bringing the children in from their play. This is the teacher holding her chalk, telling the class, sit straight, don't talk. This is the board as black as soot, and this is a snail with an itchy foot. A snail, a snail! The teacher turns pale. Look, say the children, it's leaving a trail. This is the trail of the tiny snail, a silvery trail saying, save the whale. These are the children running from school, fetching the firemen, digging a pool, squirting and spraying to keep the whale cool. This is the tide coming into the bay. And these are the villagers shouting, "Hooray!" as the whale and the snail travel safely away. Back to the duck and the flock on the rock, who said, "How time's flown, and haven't you grown?" And the whale and the snail told their wonderful tale of shimmering ice and coral caves and shooting stars and enormous waves, and of how the snail, so small and frail, with her looping, curling, silvery trail, saved the life of the humpback whale. Then the humpback whale held out his tail, and on crawled snail after snail after snail. And they sang to the sea as they all set sail on the tail of a gray-blue humpback whale. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Among some Unitarian Universalists, Christianity gets a bad rap. It's easy to understand why. In looking to distance ourselves from Christianity, its centuries of wars, persecution, the Grand Inquisition, its role in colonization, and the widespread hypocrisy of many of its followers, I, like many others, for a long time, mistakenly overlooked what is central to Christianity, the teachings of Jesus himself, upon whom the religion was constructed. In truth, it's likely we would not be speaking this morning of love at the center if Christianity had never existed. We would do well to set aside the mythos of Christianity and to differentiate Christian ideals and achievements, such as its role in the civil rights movement, liberation theology, which arose out of Latin America, and separate those from the actions that have often compromised its reputation. The practice of love in the form of agape is Christianity's gift to the world. Agape is defined as the reciprocal love between God and humanity, God's people for each other, and the common humanity and equality of all people, in the eyes of God. Before becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire and Christianity's adoption of its hierarchical structure, which established the Pope as an ecclesiastical Caesar, the ceremonies and practices of many early varieties of Christianity were often communal and egalitarian. Women were often leaders, as the Apostle Paul mentioned repeatedly in his letters found in the New Testament. Agape, in Christian terms, is a selfless, even sacrificial love committed to the well-being of the other, not only those we know, but strangers who are different and even those who despise us. Jesus says in the Gospel of Matthew, "You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." This fundamental emphasis on human equality, the worthiness of even the most humble or vile individual, and of unselfish love freely given without return is repeated throughout the Gospels in well-known parables such as the Good Samaritan, the Prodigal Son, and in the teachings of the Beatitudes, which opened Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. In fact, Christianity was the emergence of universalism in the world, part of what defines us now as a church. It's hard for us to fathom today how radical and revolutionary all this was in the early days of the Christian era, almost 2,000 years ago. These beliefs and practices were unheard of in the Greek and Roman world, even in the works of its great philosophers. And none of the axial age religions and philosophies which arose a few hundred years before Jesus emphasizes this particular quality of brother and sisterhood. But Christianity unloosed a new consciousness in the world. Over centuries, the vision of love and equality grew into the struggle to expand human rights and social justice, work that continues today. The vision of agape is embedded in the work and writings of Martin Luther King Jr., revealed in his use of the term beloved community, which he defines as one transformed by love. His mentor, the great theologian Howard Thurman, argues that the beloved community cannot be forced into existence. Rather, it grows with the transformation of the human spirit inside each one of us. And with the realization that although we all want to have somebody who cares for us, it is often more important that we have others to care for. More important that we have others to care for. That's the truth Christianity gives us, and that is the root of our theme, Love at the Center.
We know that our financial contributions to this congregation come from sacrifice and hard work. We're so grateful for this and commit together to ensure the funds we gather collectively do a greater good for ourselves and our world than they could have done alone. May we give in love and in hope. To donate via debit or credit card, you can use the QR code on the back of the order of worship, which is this. Mail checks also welcome. Our offering will now be gratefully received. Thank you for your generosity. We have one sorrow today, and I know it's on everybody's mind. This is from Elmer. I'm holding on in my heart, Alex Preddy, a nurse, a courageous, kind-hearted young man who was gunned down in the street by Federal Border Security Forces in Minneapolis. I will just share my joy so that we can leave it on a good note. My collarbone is healed. I'm feeling good. Haven't fallen down lately. The world is good. Let us hold all of our joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken, in our hearts as we join together in the responsive reading found in your order of service. Sorrow is everywhere,
yet joy is reborn.
As we mourn together,
so we celebrate together
and offer thanks
that we are not alone.
So may it be now and in all the days to come. I'm going to read for the meditation some words from Barbara Stevens, and then we'll have 60 seconds of silent meditation. Let this be a place of warm and gentle silence, the silence that soothes and comforts the wounded, the silence that yields insights into heart and soul, the silence that calms, the silence that listens, the silence that speaks, the silence that renews. Let this be a place of warm and gentle silence. Amen.
I have a brief passage this morning from Nicole Hannah Jones's The 1619 Project. It comes from the preface, so this was written by her, Nicole Hannah Jones herself. For as long as I can remember, I have been fascinated with the past. Black people, however, were largely absent from the histories I read. The vision of the past I absorbed from school textbooks, television, and the local history museum depicted a world, perhaps a wishful one, where black people did not really exist. This history rendered black Americans, black people on all the earth, inconsequential at best, invisible at worst.
And I have another short reading from Howard Zinn. You can't be neutral on a moving train. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. Well, if we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of the world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
I'd like to share with you this morning why I think public memory matters. As humans, we've been telling stories to unify us and documenting those stories since we lived in caves. That tradition is one that continues today, although we've developed quite a few more methods since our days of cave drawings. For instance, when I started college, one of the fastest ways to make new friends was to ask them what their Hogwarts house was. A decade before, Harry Potter had swept me and so many other millennials up in his magical world, and although we were technically then young adults, that story continued to connect us despite differences of race, gender, and background. One method of storytelling that has always fascinated me is that told by monuments, memorials, and markers. Built public memory, as represented by these types of objects, is intriguing because while it references the past like history, it is often formed in a very different way. As my mentor, Dr. Lydia Brandt, has written, while humans research and write history, choosing one source over another to make specific arguments, they construct memory much more collectively, organically, and emotionally. You see, we learn a lot more about the people who erect markers, memorials, and monuments than we actually do about the historical periods those objects discuss. Let's start today by talking about markers. Now, obviously, we see a few different types of markers in a town like Savannah. There are those small plaques on stones that we might see marking the location of something, some event perhaps. We see brass plaques on houses telling us when they were built, such as this one. But what I'm thinking about are those objects that are very explicit in their purpose to educate the people looking at them. They talk about someone, something, or some place from the past. And in particular today, I want to look at the state-sanctioned historical markers because these markers not only tend to be very prominently placed, but also because of their recognizable appearance, they carry a lot of authority to many people. In my work giving tours of memorial landscapes, I have noted how very few people, and I find it to be especially true of many white heteronormative people, have ever thought to question if the text on one of these markers is true. I certainly remember when I was younger, thinking that history on these objects was simply fact, and there was nothing there to question. But the truth is, history is written by people with their own biases, regardless of whether it's written in a book or in bronze. In 1951, the state legislature formed the Georgia Historical Commission. One of the three founding purposes of the commission was to put up markers connected to the sites of the Civil War. By the time the commission was disbanded in 1973, they had placed at least 1,752 markers throughout the state. They completed almost all of that work between just 1951 and 1963. In that 12-year time frame, they averaged placing more than 100 markers per year. As a historian, I can say that is a lot of information to fact check. Do you think it's possible that every single story on those markers is correct? It was rhetorical, but thank you. Even if every statement is correct, do you think the stories we were telling on those markers in the 1950s and 1960s represent all Georgians today? In 1954, this marker at the old Sorrelweed House was erected. The facts on this marker are true, but I ask you if they really capture the full story. It begins, a fine example of Greek Revival style, this building shows the distinguished trend of Savannah architecture during the first half of the 19th century. So we learn about the house some. That seems fairly straightforward. The marker continues. The Mediterranean villa influence reflects the French background of the original owner, Francis Sorrel, who, as a child, was saved by a faithful slave in the massacre of the white colonists in Saint-Domingue. We certainly don't use this terminology today, saying slave instead of enslaved person, robs Sorrel's rescuer of their humanity. We also don't learn anything about this person beyond the fact they rescued Francis Sorrel and that they were enslaved. How old was this person? What was their gender? Most significantly, what was this person's name? We don't get any more information about the uprising mentioned, which, by the way, that uprising was the Haitian Revolution, which is the revolution that led to the first free black republic and was led by self-liberated people. The text goes on. Here resided as youth Jean Moxley Sorrel, who achieved fame as one of Lee's lieutenants. Shortly after war broke out in 1861, Sorrel, a young bank clerk in Savannah, proceeded to Virginia where, actually, there's a lot there, and I'm going to skip some of that. So I'm skipping forward, but it kind of goes on in the same vein. He, meaning Sorrel, served with conspicuous valor and zeal through the major battles and campaigns in that theater from the First Manassas to Petersburg and was thrice wounded. Here the phrase, conspicuous valor and zeal, always stands out to me. Is that what we're supposed to think about the bloodiest conflict in American history? That it was valorous to fight to maintain the enslavement of an entire group of people based on their skin color? The facts presented on this marker aren't necessarily wrong, and how this story is presented and who we talk about still erase so many people from the history of our community. Civil War memory and Confederate monuments have been discussed in wider circles in recent years, and rightly so, in my opinion. The fact that objects dedicated to people who met the literal definition of traitor in the U.S. Constitution were allowed to stand unquestioned by so many people in power for so long is a fact that I think we should all ponder regularly. Returning to the Sorrel Weed House marker, we have to ask why it was important to share a Civil War story on that particular spot in 1954. For some context, Vice President of the Confederacy Alexander Stevens proclaimed in March 1861, actually right here in Savannah, that the Confederacy's foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. A study by the University of Virginia found a strong correlation between the sites of racially motivated lynchings and the locations of Confederate monuments. I think that correlation shows that the same attitudes that led to the erection of Confederate monuments led to racially motivated lynchings. Let's turn our attention now to a different object. The Oglethorpe Monument here in Savannah was unveiled in 1910 during a period often referred to as the Golden Age of Confederate Monuments by historians because of the huge number of these objects that were going up. Viewing the monument today, most people only see a celebration of Georgia's founding father. During the speech at the unveiling, J. Randolph Anderson, who was the chair of the committee in charge of erecting this monument, said, "The Battle of Bloody Marsh that day decided that the Anglo-Saxon and not the Castilian was to be the master of the New World." Anglo-Saxon was shorthand in the early 20th century for white, and people from Southern Europe and the Mediterranean, such as the Castilians referred to here or the Spanish, were not considered white. With that early 20th century meaning of Anglo-Saxon in mind, I'll read that unveiling quote again. "The battle that day decided that the Anglo-Saxon and not the Castilian was to be the master of the New World." In 1910, this monument told a story celebrating white rule in North America. The unveiling occurred during the height of Jim Crow segregation, and this monument is just as much a product of the desire for a white supremacist racial order as any Confederate monument. So what do we do? Markers and monuments like these two, they are all over the place, not just in Savannah or Georgia, but across the country. Well, by simply maintaining them, without any conversation or questioning, we are maintaining that their stories represent us, our values, what our community means to us. They show who is a part of our community and who is excluded. As Nicole Hannah-Jones pointed out, people and groups absent from histories, whether those histories are written in books or in bronze, are inconsequential at best, invisible at worst. There is currently no process to revise these state-sanctioned historical markers unless they are found to be factually incorrect, as in, you discover a name is misspelled or a date is wrong type of incorrect. All over Savannah, there are many markers like that at the Sorrel Weed House that are not factually incorrect, and yet they still erase the presence of so many of us from our past. These markers could be revised to present a more connected and inclusive interpretation of our history. We have the power locally to write and enforce an ordinance to address our memorial landscape. For instance, what if we automatically required the regular review of older objects so that they are kept in step with current understandings of history? For the Oglethorpe Monument, a more powerful statement than simple removal is counter-memorialization. Georgia wasn't built physically by Oglethorpe. He wasn't here building the buildings of Savannah. Enslaved people were. He's not the one that planted rice or cotton. He definitely wasn't the first person in this geographic area, and he couldn't even speak the local language. Many accounts point to Mary Musgrove translating for him. What would it be like to have a memorial to the people who were enslaved and indentured and labored to actually construct our community here, standing next to and just as proudly as the Oglethorpe Monument? Can you imagine what it would be like to have a memorial to the indigenous people who lived here first, standing boldly in Chippewa Square? Objects we pass often without paying too much attention, they matter. Built public memory is very intentional, and even if we, adult residents, pass markers and monuments every day and don't really pay attention, people that visit here do. Children pay attention to what objects are telling them about who their community is and if they themselves are included. It's important that we critically examine the objects that we still have up, like the Oglethorpe Monument, like the old historic markers, and it's equally important that we put up new public memory, that we leave our mark on the landscape, saying what matters to us, how we are all connected through our shared humanity. We need to put up markers and memorials and monuments that counter the stories that have divided us. We need more of these objects that represent and connect just not just our community, but the entire country, and I would venture that we need them more than ever in 2026. I'll leave you with this final thought. It's okay for our understanding of history to change. In history, we discuss the past as best we understand it with the sources we have available to us in that moment. Sometimes we find a new source and it reveals something we didn't know. It changes our perspective. And because it changes our understanding, we change history. We literally write the new narrative as it fits the evidence we have in that moment. We don't do this with public memory. And we could. We know that history is not written in stone. So if we know history is not written in stone, why is public memory? May we all leave this place today sharing the past here in the present in a way that builds a more just future. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.